From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on assignment today. Coming up, she speaks with actress Melanie Mayron. She's on TV in the series 30-something, and she stars in the new film Sticky Fingers, which she also co-wrote. Also today, I speak with biologist Daniel Janssen. For nearly 30 years, Janssen has been negotiating with landowners, government bureaucrats, and foundations, all in an effort to save a piece of Costa Rican forest. In less than a week, America's greatest songwriter turns 100 years old. In honor of Irving Berlin's birthday, Susanna McCorkle performs a couple of Berlin tunes. And you may have wondered why there are so many mediocre films on home video. That same question occurred to critic Ken Tucker. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air.
A lot of women identify with the character Melanie Mayron plays in the TV series 30-something. She plays Melissa, a struggling freelance photographer who is single, wants to start a family, but can't find the man to start it with. In a way, this role is a continuation of Mayron's character in the 1978 film Girlfriends. She starred as a freelance photographer in her 20s, having a hard time establishing her financial and emotional independence. You may also remember Melanie Mayron from her roles in Harry and Tonto, Missing, and Playing for Time. Her new movie is in many ways her own movie. She co-produced, co-wrote, and co-stars in the comedy Sticky Fingers. She and Helen Slater play two broke musicians sharing an apartment. A friend who deals marijuana asks to leave a suitcase at their place. After the friend leaves, the roommates open the suitcase and discover it contains close to $1 million. The temptation is too great. They dig into the money, pay off the rent, then go on a compulsive shopping spree, swearing they'll pay back the money. Denitra Vance plays a friend who warns them they are out of control and in big trouble.
$194,000. You could be killed. This could be mafia money. Big men in big suits with big guns could come here and drag you off by the hair. You should be scared. They could put a bomb in your car.
We don't have a car.
We could get one for the new equipment.
Maybe a van.
That's stealing. You're stealing. That's what it's called. Stealing.
You're right. I've tried to stop. I really have. Every day I try not to do it. Every day I tell myself today I am not going to go shopping. But then I'm out there, and I'm surrounded by things, and I can't help myself.
I had to buy a dress, but a dress, one dress with a nice cut, good fabric, flattering line, costs $3,000, and with accessories, that's another $4,500 right there.
Can I have some more champagne?
We need help, Evan.
We don't know what else to do.
Melanie Mayron, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
That's a very funny premise for this new movie. What gave you the idea of these, you know, two women who come into this money and become compulsive shoppers?
Well, Catlin Adams, who co-wrote and co-produced the film with me, we had been writing some other scripts that never were made. We wrote a few TV films for CBS, and they weren't made. We wrote a film for Canon. It wasn't made. You know, out in L.A., the studios develop tons and tons of projects, and they pay writers, and they only make X amount of them. And we were just tired of everything we've written not ever getting to the screen, so we decided to come up with a story that we could produce ourselves. We had these two characters, Lolly and Hattie, that were sort of like patterned after a female Laurel and Hardy. You know, one who's quieter and less confrontational, and one who will blurt out anything and, you know, not be afraid of confrontation. And one of Catlin's favorite films was always Some Like It Hot, which had Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis as two musicians on the run. And we'd also been going to the movies and, you know, never seeing enough women up there on the screen. You know, so many of the stories were great stories and terrific, but it was rare that, you know, I wanted to, like, you know, see role models up there too and identify and, you know, just see more actresses. Being an actress, I wanted to be able to work more too. So Callan came up with the idea of a bag of money, and, you know, you pick up these two people struggling. You know, we were like actresses, writers that were struggling with our careers, so we just made them musicians, and they were behind on their rent, and, you know, things weren't going as well as they should. And suddenly this bag of money comes into their apartment, literally, and you know, what would happen to really honest, good people when temptation is literally under their nose and events happen in their lives that push them over the edge? And how really, you know, money can destroy friendship, but also it be about how it destroys their other relationships. And it, we took the approach of a fable.
You know, I think in a lot of male versions of this movie, the two characters would have gambled away the money or something like that. Now, you have your gambling scene in it, but in this version, the two women shop it all away. They become compulsive shoppers. Did you feel like you knew or that you are yourself an addicted shopper?
I don't spend money when I don't have it. You know, I mean, you hear stories about some people that'll take a credit card, use it up, right, to the limit, pay the monthly payments, and then get out another credit card with another $2,000 limit. That I've never, you know, been like that. I, if I didn't have money, I would just window shop. You know, I mean, I just enjoyed looking at things.
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting. You went to, like, role models and things. So what you've done is a comedy. It's not, you know, the two women in it aren't like, when I grow up, I'd like to be like Lolly in the movie Sticky Fingers. I mean, they're not role models in that respect.
No, but it's where women can go to the movies and relate and have fun. You know, it's I wanted to, well, we both wanted to have a movie that we wanted to see, you know, and that's what we wanted to make.
Well, this is the first time you've actually gotten to act in a movie that you've written, a part that you've written for yourself. Were there little personal touches that you put in because you knew you'd like to do that as an actress?
The overall concept, I mean, I haven't been in a comedy in a long time, and I very much wanted to do a role where I could do both, where the emotional work would be there and the comedic work would be substantiated by the emotional work, but, you know, it would also be funny. I think when an actor is really emotionally into a scene, I mean, when you're really hysterical, but you say something because you know you're going to say it in a funny way, it's like the best that comedy can be.
I think it's the ambition of many actors and actresses to make their own movies, but few actually succeed in doing it. Now, you co-produced this film. Did you have to shop it around to a lot of investors before making it?
Yeah, we sure did. We started this project 5 years ago. It took 3 years to write it and package it with a group of actors that we could say, these actors will do it when we get the money, and hear yes from a studio or from a company. We took it to all the Hollywood studios, and none of them wanted to make a film that starred two women, because at the time there weren't any films out there that were starring two women, and it, after all, it is a business. You know, then Outrageous Fortune came out, and, you know, $90 million later, thank you, they went, oh, well, gee, you know, I guess people will go see a film with two women. When Desperately Seeking Susan came out, they considered that a fluke.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know what I think might have been awkward when you were, as a producer, taking the script around trying to get backing for it? The backers always want to know who are the stars going to be, and of course one of them was going to be you. And I can imagine how you must have felt with potential backers saying to you, well, I don't think Melanie Mayron is a big enough star for us to invest our money in. Did that happen?
Well, yeah. I mean, I knew that the secret of this film would be the ensemble, you know, the level of actors that we got. I knew that, you know, I mean, I wasn't like, you know, Bette Midler or Goldie Hawn or somebody. I was just me, you know. And it would be whoever I was with as Hattie and the rest of the group. And that in tandem with the script, which I thought was good and funny and that people would identify with, and also the budget. The budget was $3.25 million. It's a low budget for Hollywood. Hollywood film is, I'd say $8 million is pretty much considered low budget for Hollywood, and about 12 to 15 is average.
If you're just joining us, my guest is actress Melanie Mayron, who also co-produced and co-wrote the movie that she's now starring in, which is called Sticky Fingers. It's a comedy. Did you have to develop a whole new persona as a producer?
No, I think I always had a gift of being a producer. I've always gotten along with people really well, and had a great interest in all aspects of filmmaking and loved to, you know, recognize different people's talents in different areas. And I just had a blast. It seemed like a real natural, you know, segue from acting and from writing.
You know, you mentioned how cheap the movie was to do. One of the ways of keeping a movie cheap is to have the actors and actresses work cheap. Now, I think you got a lot of your friends to work on the movie. I could see that being kind of awkward, too, deciding whether you were going to ask them to you know, to work at the lowest wage that you could get away with or not, you know. It's, on the one hand, you want, you know, you want your friends to be in the movie and everything. On the other hand, you'd like to offer them as much money as possible, I'm sure. So what was that like for you?
It was tricky. I mean, that's why the movie took so long, I think, to write, to get it to a place where we felt comfortable, because we would write the script and we'd say, Eileen, what do you think of the role of Stella the landlady, to Eileen Brennan, and she'd give her comments, and if she wasn't, you know, she knew that once she said yes, based on her availability, whenever we got the money, she would do it and she would work for scale. Same thing with Carol Kane and Peter Riegert, we had developed the role of Sam for, but at the end, last year when we were finally ready to go, Peter was doing The Nerd on Broadway and couldn't do the film. So we got it to Chris Guest, who I had also done Girlfriends with. He'd played my boyfriend in that. And this little film that kind of came and went several years back called Heartbeeps with Andy Kaufman and Bernadette Peters. And Chris and I were, like, together in that. So he got the script, and he said, well, I think that Sam is a little bit of a heel, and I don't really want to play somebody, and I don't think he's sympathetic enough. So we looked at the role of Sam again and made some changes and just made him very confused, and I think it helped. And Chris said, okay, I'll do it for scale.
Mm-hmm. Melanie Mayron is my guest, and she co-wrote, co-produced, and stars in the new comedy Sticky Fingers. Now, our listeners will also know you from your role in 30-something as Melissa, the photographer and single woman. how did you get the part in that?
Well, last February, a year ago February, we were trying to make the deal with Sticky Fingers with Spectra Film. And our lawyer, we had completely become Lolly and Hattie by the end of 4 years. We were completely broke. It's like change your career, become an independent producer, and go broke. And that's exactly what had happened. And I didn't have the money for the rent. And my agent sent me a script of a pilot, and I've never been open to pilots and always kind of steered clear of the series commitment because I love doing movies and theater and good TV movies, and I liked having the freedom to bounce around, although in the last 4 years it's not like I was getting hired for much. But I got this script called 30-something, and there were two women's roles in it. One was this character Hope, and the other was her friend Ellen. Hope was married, and Ellen is this woman in business, sort of like Diane Keaton in Baby Boom. I thought, what a great role. I'd love to play this character. So I went up, auditioned for the role, did my best. I thought I gave a really good audition. And they said, well, that was really good, Melanie. Thank you. Could you read for the role of Melissa? And I said, Melissa who? I mean, I, like, didn't remember her in the script. There were apparently two other women in the script, Melissa and Nancy, who kind of came in and came out, and that was it, but at least in the pilot. But they said, no, 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 if this series sells, these are seven equal characters, it's an ensemble story, and each week we'll get and see somebody else's life. So it turned out I got the part. And I said, well, okay, I'll do it because, you know, most pilots never sell, and all my friends do pilots every year, and they never sell. And I didn't know really who this Melissa character was, and I was a little panicky that if you sign for 5 years, I went, you know, boy, I really don't know who Melissa is. But I also didn't think it would sell, and I really wanted to make my movie, and I really wanted to be able to pay my lawyer so he could close the deal with Spectra Film so we could go make Sticky Fingers. So that's what I did.
And now you're actually in the series, and I guess you're signed to a 5-year contract?
Yeah.
So are you pleased?
Well, when I first heard, I was up in Toronto. We shot Sticky Fingers 2 weeks in New York and 5 weeks in Toronto. And I was night shooting, and I got home at like 8 in the morning, crawled into bed. I was like asleep for 2.5 hours, and at 10:30, my agent called me from New York and said, Melanie, I've got great news. And I said, yeah, what, Tim, huh? I was like sound asleep. And he goes, the pilot sold! And not only did it sell, but ABC is so excited. They're giving it the best time slot they got of the new season, Tuesday night, 10 o'clock, following Moonlight. Isn't that fantastic? I was like, fantastic. That's fantastic. I was like, I couldn't believe it. It wasn't that I was like, it wasn't that I was not thrilled. I mean, my God, I have been scarfing and scraping money-wise for so many years, borrowing money from my parents and friends and, you know, getting up with money and then, like, you know, spending money on Sticky Fingers and, you know, being broke again. What scared me was that I didn't know what part I had signed for. You know, I mean, I know the power of TV. I've had friends over the years, one by one, they've become rich and famous. And like Carol Kane, she's done series and she's still doing movies. Danny DeVito, he's still doing, you know what I mean? If anything else, the TV helped their film career. So I knew that it could only help me and the exposure would help me, but I just didn't know who in the world Melissa was.
Well, in a way, I think viewers didn't really know who she was until several months, actually, because for a while, your character was just like the friend or the cousin in a very peripheral role, and then more recently, you started getting like episodes that you'd star in, stories about your life.
Right. I think.
Did you push for that?
When we started it in the pilot, she was a friend. And she had had a past relationship with Gary, Michael's best friend, and that was it. And they were now all friends. And when we got back, I mean, when we started for real last August, they said, well, we're going to make Melissa Michael's cousin. I said, oh, okay. And I said, well, what does she do? It's like, oh, we don't know. Nobody knew. And I said, well, look, you've already got one single woman. You know, now you've got two. And it's like, how are you going to make the definition between us? So I suggested she be a photographer because I thought that way she's in a freelance career, kind of like me and all my friends that I know, right? Since they already had a single character in a regular corporate, you know, 9-to-5 situation. Because otherwise I didn't know what would really define us or differentiate between us. And then I thought, if she's in a freelance career, at least I can relate to somebody on the show, you know. I could watch 30-something and see what Melissa's doing with her life and kind of know what to do with mine, or at least commiserate.
Go ahead.
No, and you know, a photographer was at least something visual. You know, if I was a writer or a painter, you know, it wouldn't really be, you know, you couldn't really look at it or use it. It's just somebody sitting, you know. So photographer is kind of like visual, and you could see me working on things. And I also thought it could tie in with cousin Michael and Elliot's advertising company, you know, which in fact they wound up doing.
Just a quick question about 30-something. I think when the series started, a lot of people thought it would be the TV version of the movie The Big Chill. And a lot of people feared, too, that it was just going to be a series designed to attract yuppies because they had a lot of money to spend and it would be good for demographics for the advertisers.
Right.
Do you feel that people were working hard to make it be something bigger than that?
Well, the creators and the producers and the writers sure were. I don't think they ever thought about demographics. I think they thought the same way that Catelyn and I thought about Sticky Fingers. We made that movie because it was a movie we wanted to see. They developed the show because they wanted to get into the daily exploration of daily problems and things that were concerning them. The two creators are married. One's had a marriage that's been rocky, but they've survived, and they have two kids, and the other creator has a happy marriage, and they, I think, wanted to get into the lives of themselves and all their friends.
My guest is Melanie Mayron, and she co-stars in the TV series 30-something. She plays the role of Melissa, the freelance photographer. She also stars, co-wrote, and co-produced the new comedy Sticky Fingers. We're going to talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Melanie Mayron is my guest. Let me ask you, when you're doing a weekly series like 30-something, when do you find out how big your part is that week? Do you know before you get the script, or do you just find out when the scripts are handed out?
Well, the show takes 8 days to shoot, and the last day of one show, you have a read-through at lunch break of the next show that's going to start the next day or the next, you know, after the weekend. And you usually get it just a couple days before. Mm-hmm. There's no rehearsal.
Really?
None.
Yeah. You know, I was just watching again the first movie that you starred in, and that was Girlfriends, an independent movie that was made back in, was it 1978?
Yeah.
In Girlfriends, you played someone who was still kind of insecure, coming into her own, single. And in a lot of ways, it's very similar to the character you play on 30-something. Do you see a connection between the two?
Yes, it's just that in 30-something, Melissa is 30-something and not 20-something.
Right.
I think that the difference between Melissa and Susan in Girlfriends is that Melissa, I don't know where Susan would be in 10 years. You know, Claudia Weill directed two of the episodes this year and said to me, we should think about doing a sequel to Girlfriends. And I said, what a great idea, because it'd be fascinating to, you know, see what would have happened to her. But Melissa, and the way I've approached Melissa, and tried to maintain it with each script is just someone who's not willing to compromise. She is in her 30s. She's had a dream to be this photographer. She doesn't have as much money as her cousin Michael or anyone else, any of his friends. She's still, you know, scarfing. She's making do. And she doesn't want to just be with someone just to be with them. She'd rather be alone if she's not going to be in love.
You know, one of the things I noticed watching Girlfriends the other night was how you've really changed physically. You really look just about completely different. You're much thinner now. The shape of your face seems to have changed. What's behind the metamorphosis?
I had some braces on my teeth for 5 years that were on and off, and I lost some weight, and I had my nose shortened to hair.
Oh.
Still the same shape. It was just shortened to hair.
Mm-hmm. Is it necessary to do that kind of thing to get the kind of parts you want?
I just, no. Well, with me, I just always thought I had my mother's and my sister's nose. And then I, like, saw myself in film a few times, and I saw myself from the side, and I went, oh, it's just like their nose, but just a hair longer. And I just, it was really funny, because it's like, how did I get to be, like, you know, 20-something and, like, not know what my face looked like? But I think whenever you look at yourself in the mirror, you know, I mean, you always see yourself straight on, right? And when I'd look at myself straight on, I looked fine. But from the side, or when I smiled, I saw that, you know, it went down just a touch. You know, I think if I'd had a nose like Meryl Streep's or Barbara Streisand's, you know, where it was a real specific size and shape, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't have done anything to it, but it really wasn't. It was just kind of like a nice nose, just a little too long, you know, so it was a real easy thing.
You know, although you are really striking now and you're very, very attractive, you carry yourself on 30-something as if you know what it's like to be very self-conscious and to feel very awkward and to feel very kind of uncomfortable with yourself,
mm-hmm.
You know, and it's a kind of interesting contrast in a way, because, you know, you're very, very good looking, yet you have the kind of, in this role, in 30-something, you communicate this discomfort, this physical discomfort.
Well, maybe it is my physical discomfort with myself. Maybe I'm not used to, I don't know. I haven't worked a lot prior to this last year.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also thinner. I'd lost weight about 5-8 years ago, and it's like I've kept it off. And I think I just haven't worked, and I haven't been working out. And, you know, I think I have a posture problem. I think, Terry, you know, you're telling me some interesting
You know, in your two biggest roles in Girlfriends and in 30-something, you've played a single woman who would like to not be single. So can I ask you, are you single yourself? Do you identify with those roles?
Yeah, but I don't think I play someone who would like to not be single. That's what I've been trying to, like, make sure doesn't happen on the show. I think that what I've been trying to do is play someone who doesn't mind being single. She'd rather be single than be with someone. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It's like I think that if a woman gets to her 30s, you know, she's not every day waking up and going, oh, gosh, you know, I've got to have a man in my life. I think she's more, you know, she's caught up in her life and what's happening in her work and all of that, and where she is and how she's feeling that day. I think that she's not desperate, you know, for love. I think she's a little relaxed about it. I think that's the difference with when you're in your 30s. I think in your 20s, you know, you are desperate. You're kind of like, you know, looking around. Who is there? Who's cute? Who can I go out with? You know, so-and-so's going out with somebody. Who can I, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And in that 10-year difference, you just settle into yourself more.
You grew up in suburban Philadelphia.
Right.
When you were coming of age and deciding that you really would love to act, did you feel that you'd never be able to figure out how to get there from here? Living, you know, just living in a kind of ordinary, comfortable, suburban-type lifestyle?
Yeah, I knew that, you know, you had to go to New York. I mean, that seemed to be the place to go. I worked for 2 summers at LaSalle College Music Theater in Philadelphia, and met a lot of people and really got a taste of the theater there, and went to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts for 2 years in New York. That kind of like instead of going to high school, I went there. Although, you know, I was the editor of my high school newspaper at Wissahickon Senior High School in Ambler, Pennsylvania, and I always loved writing. And my biggest dilemma, my parents helped me out a lot with this, because I wanted to either be go into journalism or photojournalism, because I also loved photography. And I've been a photographer. That's what's kept me alive all these years. When I, between acting parts, I'd take actors' headshots. And I think that the acting kind of took off. My parents said, look, go to the American Academy for a year, see if they ask you back for the second year, because that's the kind of school it was. They took anybody the first year, and then they'd ask a third of the class back. And they said, you know, because for acting you don't need a college degree, but if it doesn't work out, if they don't ask you back, then it'll mean, I mean, they're the professionals, they know, then it'll mean, well, you weren't meant to do it, and you can go to college and, you know, concentrate on photography or writing or whatever. So now it seems like filmmaking is kind of like, was everything I was ever interested in back then, you know? It's combining everything, the photography, the writing, the acting, and everything I've learned from all three.
I have to tell you, a couple of years ago, I noticed on the TV page that you were going to be appearing in a rerun of what I think was a made-for-TV movie called something like Centerfold. So I stayed up late to see to see what this movie was. And I think you played opposite Don Johnson in it. I forget what year this was made.
Yeah, Kim Basinger was the Centerfold, Katie. And I was her best friend, and I had a husband who Don Johnson played. And we had, there was some waif off the street who was played by an actress named Terry Nunn, who in fact is the lead singer for the group Berlin. I mean, this little TV movie had, everybody was like nowhere then.
That's right. I think it's very funny to look back on things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you like to watch those when they come on?
You know, I haven't been watching much TV over the years, and so, but I always hear somebody says, oh, Hustling was on, or Centerfold was on. It's like, oh, God. Sometimes when I've seen them, it's like a time machine. It's scary.
Are you doing roles like that anymore, made-for-TV movies?
Well, yeah, I've been, I mean, the last, you know, am I doing, like, it's my choice. Terry, it's like whether I get hired or not.
Right, of course. Let me just stop you right here. Why is it, do you think, that you hadn't gotten lots of roles in the past few years until 30-something in your new movie?
I moved to New York 5 years ago. So, first of all, there's a lot less work in New York than there is in L.A. I did a few days' work on an after-school special that Lee Grant directed called Cindy Eller. I spent 3 weeks in Yugoslavia doing a miniseries, a two-nighter for NBC called Wallenberg, A Hero Story, about Raoul Wallenberg during World War II, and with Richard Chamberlain. I played his secretary. I did another after-school special, one day's work in it, that Catlin directed, who directed Sticky Fingers. And I did a play at the Jewish Repertory Theater in New York called Crossing Delancey. The playwright wrote the role for me. I created it, and now, of course, Amy Irving has done it in a film. But so I did work, you know, but I went up for lots of stuff. I just, you know, that this is what I got. And actually, I kind of look back at it because it's like fate. You know, I go, well, if I had been doing a lot of acting work in the last 5 years, I certainly couldn't have been in Sticky Fingers, because that needed the full attention and commitment that it got.
Well, I wish you the best with your new movie, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
My guest has been Melanie Mayron, and she co-produced, co-wrote, and stars in the new film, Sticky Fingers. It's a comedy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Jay McInerney. The success of his first novel, the semi-autobiographical Bright Lights, Big City, set off a wave of new young writers who were tagged literature's Brat Pack. He wrote the screenplay for the film of Bright Lights, Big City, which stars Michael J. Fox. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on assignment. Coming up, I speak with someone who can only be described as a man possessed. Biologist Daniel Jansen has devoted 3 decades of his life to saving a piece of tropical rainforest. Also, singer Susanna McCorkle is featured in our weekly performance spot. She kicks off a month-long celebration of Irving Berlin's 100th birthday. And critic Ken Tucker examines why, more and more, the worst movies make their way into home video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. Unemployment fell to 5.4% last month. The April jobless rate was 0.2 points lower than the month before, and it was the lowest rate in 14 years. President Reagan called the report good news. Private analysts agreed, although some of them voiced concerns that the tighter job market is bound to push wages up soon and create inflationary pressures. Most of the improvement in the unemployment figures came among adult men. More than half of the strikers at the Lenin shipyard in Gdansk have gone home amid growing pressure from the Polish government to end the week-long walkout. NPR's Bill Buesenberg has details.
The atmosphere inside the shipyard is described as bad, very tense. The strikers are under great stress. For one thing, food supplies are running low, and riot police have blocked off all avenues of resupply. Until yesterday, young people with backpacks of groceries had been finding ways through police lines. In addition to cutting off food supplies, authorities are exerting psychological pressure on the strikers. Outside the two main gates, often during the night, riot police conduct exercises, simulating attacks on the shipyard. Inside the giant shipyard, also at night, groups of what are described as civil service agents have been catching isolated strikers and handing them over to police. According to one person who left the shipyard today, the whole government strategy seems to be to avoid a direct assault and wear down the strikers by hunger and fear until they finally give up. I'm Bill Buesenberg in Warsaw.
President Reagan today expressed some displeasure with the growing library of kiss-and-tell books that have been authored by his former advisors. Mr. Reagan seemed especially upset with the writings of his former chief of staff, Donald Regan. Details from NPR's Brian Naylor.
Michael Deaver has written one, so has Terrell Bell, Larry Speaks, and now Donald Regan. The former chief of staff's book on the Reagan administration is due to be published next week. President Reagan, who left this afternoon for Camp David, said he doesn't expect to spend much time reading these books over the weekend.
I've tried to avoid commenting on all the kiss-and-tell books, but I doubt that they will be on my reading list either.
The president appeared none too happy with Regan's book, which reveals the first family's fascination with astrology. Asked if Regan had sent him the book, the president said no and, quote, "I don't think he's going to send one unless I'm prepared to send a check in return." And the president, who in happier times used to joke with Regan each morning, said he would have preferred his chief of staff attack him. But, said Mr. Reagan, "he's chosen to attack my wife, and I don't look kindly upon that at all." I'm Brian Naylor at the White House.
According to French television, France and Iran are about to resume diplomatic relations. The reports say the move is part of the deal worked out to win the freedom of 3 hostages released this week from Lebanon. France and Iran broke diplomatic relations last summer over an Iranian embassy employee's refusal to testify about a series of bombings in Paris. In Washington, State Department spokesman Charles Redmond said France's open appreciation of Iran's help in freeing the hostages leaves no doubt about Iranian control over the kidnappers.
We note that the French government has publicly thanked Iran for its assistance in arranging the release, and the government of Iran has taken credit for the release of the French hostages. Once again, this demonstrates the substantial influence Iran holds over terrorist kidnappers.
Former hostage Jean-Paul Kaufman said today his kidnappers told him all of the Western hostages in Lebanon are alive, but he said the American hostages were badly treated because they tried to escape. Medicare will run into financial trouble in the next 20 years, and Social Security will be out of money by the year 2048. That's according to a report from the boards of trustees of both the funds. They say bankruptcy can only be averted if Congress takes action to curb health care costs. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Today on our weekly performance spot, we begin a special series in honor of Irving Berlin, who celebrates his 100th birthday this month. Susanna McCorkle is one of today's most gifted interpreters of American popular song. We asked her to come and pay tribute to Irving Berlin.
One of the things that just fascinates me about Irving Berlin as a songwriter, besides the fact that he's lived to be 100 years old, I already don't know how he did that, is the way his songs have lasted. I think a lot of this is because they were on universal themes. Of course, there's love, missing someone, longing. But there are also just a lot of banal, everyday things that he made special songs out of that still sound great and are a lot of fun to sing. I'd like to do two songs about the weather, even though both are out of season right now. I only get to do the winter one in the winter and the summer one in the summer, but every year I really look forward to pulling them out and doing them. I've Got My Love to Keep Me Warm is from the 1937 show On the Avenue.
The snow is snowing, the wind is blowing, but I will weather the storm. What do I care how much it may storm? To keep me warm, I can't remember a worse December. Just watch those icicles form. What do I care if icicles form? I've got my love to keep me warm. Off with my overcoat, off with my gloves. No overcoat, I'm burning with love. My heart's on fire, the flame grows higher. So I will weather the storm. What do I care how much it may storm? I've got my love to keep me warm. Off with my overcoat, off with my glove. No overcoat, I'm burning with love. My heart's on fire, the flame grows higher. So I will weather the storm. What do I care how much it may storm? I've got my love.
And in the summer, I like to get this one out about the heat. My first memory of it as a little girl, I saw the movie There's No Business Like Show Business, which had everybody in it. It had Dan Daly, it had Ethel Merman, Johnny Ray went away to war in the middle of it, and of course it had Marilyn. This was my first glimpse of Marilyn. She did a big production number to this. A wonderful record was made of it by Ethel Waters. It's from a musical called As Thousands Cheer, 1933.
It's so hot. The weatherman will tell you a record's been made. It's so hot a coat of tan will cover your face in the shade. It's so hot the coldest maiden acts just as warm as a bride. It's so hot a chicken laid an egg in the street and it fried. We're having a heat wave, a tropical heat wave. The temperature's rising, it isn't surprising. She certainly can. She started this heat wave by letting her seat wave. And in such a way that the customers say that she certainly can. Gee, her anatomy made the mercury jump to 93. Yes, sir, we're having a heat wave, that she moves, that thermometer proves that she certainly can. We're having a heat wave, a heat wave. She certainly can. She certainly can. She certainly can. Can.
Singer Susanna McCorkle was joined by pianist Ben Aronoff and bassist Chip Jackson. We'll be hearing more from Susanna McCorkle on future editions of our program. This is Fresh Air. Daniel Jansen is a man with a mission. His dream is to rebuild a tropical forest in the northwest of Costa Rica. For the past 30 years, he has journeyed to a 420-square-mile area of Central America to study how plants and animals interrelate in the tropics. In 1984, Jansen received the Crawford Prize from the Swedish Academy of Sciences. This prize is regarded among biologists as the equivalent of a Nobel Prize. Jansen is a hands-on kind of scientist. He's more content working in the field than in the laboratory. He spends half a year in Costa Rica and the other half teaching at the University of Pennsylvania. I asked him why it's important to preserve plant and animal diversity.
The first way that animal and plant diversity is of real interest to humans is that we do not exist by ourselves. We exist by eating, making use of as commercial products, and by direct aesthetic and intellectual involvement with all these different things. If we reduce those down to a very few species, then we are confronted with a very, very impoverished array of things from which to choose what we want to use. Now, at the present time, all of the Earth's crops and, well, crops and animals that we use for food, if you take all of those, probably 25 species, maybe 30 species cover the bulk, the vast majority of what we eat and use. What we're saying then is, if we just write off the rest of the species, what we're saying is that our ancestors 5,000 years ago, when they picked out those 20, 30, 40 species of animals and plants, did the best possible job of selecting what was out there, which is, of course, absurd.
You're saying, though, that the human species could survive, but it would survive in a very constricted and different kind of way than it has
survived before. I think it could, just like cows survive in a field. You can take a cow, put it in a field of alfalfa, and raise it generation after generation after generation. The question is, do we want to be cows in a field of alfalfa?
But I think people often don't connect that idea of being a cow in a field with alfalfa with saving a forest in Costa Rica.
That's right, because a lot of people, one, don't realize the global nature of our contact. You see, we sit down here, we go to the A&P, and we buy all these groceries. And you come home with of wide variety of things and makes you happy for your meals and all that sort of thing. Now, let's take that list of groceries and ask what fraction of it came from the tropics.
Right.
Well, it turns out that about 80% of the species that you eat are tropical in origin. And people, I think, often don't realize this. Just take breakfast, for example.
Right.
It's coffee and tea and sugar, cinnamon, eggs, citrus, pork, anything from a chicken, milk, beans, any product made from corn, like cornflakes or anything like that. And that's just the breakfast part of the day. And if we just go on through the rest of the day, what you discover is a very large number of our crops and the animals that we eat have their historical origins in tropical species, not in temperate zones. If we didn't have the tropics, we'd be living on acorns and rye and wheat.
You spend about half the year in Costa Rica and the other half the year in the States. And when you're in Costa Rica, you're up at dawn and you're exploring and you're gathering. And I'm curious about what you're looking for when you spend the time down there.
What I'm trying to do is come to understand how a particular tropical forest, a dry forest in my case, how a particular tropical dry forest functions, meaning what are the interactions between the animals and the plants? What difference does it make if we lose this species or that species, or if we add this species or that species? I'm also trying to understand how it is that if we go out and remove a piece of that forest, you cut it down to make a pasture out of it, for example, or whatever it is, what are the processes that bring that forest back onto that piece of land that you've removed the forest from?
A friend said about you, Jansen is the only person who can fall in a pile of manure and come up with a new species of dung beetle.
Mm-hmm. I think I would answer that by saying that maybe I'm one of those people who, when I fall in the pile of manure, wouldn't be so concerned about getting out as looking to see whether there was a new species of dung beetle in it. I see, my response to the world is curiosity. I mean, I sit and I look around this studio, and my reaction to it is not a hostile environment, even though I don't understand it, but my reaction is sort of why. I'm still an 8-year-old kid, twiddling dials and pulling wires and wondering why these things work. And I've fallen into the fortunate situation in this society where I'm applauded and supported to continue to act like an 8-year-old kid.
Your love of nature, though, really does come from your childhood when you roamed and trapped and...
Sure.
And,
well, I was blessed with a pair of parents who thought that was a legitimate way to spend your life.
Mm-hmm.
And so that as I became involved with trapping and collecting butterflies and doing all these kinds of things, they encouraged me to just keep on doing that. So that, by being encouraged to do that, that made me different from the other kids around me who were being discouraged to do these sorts of things. And again, my parents in the early days did not discourage me from that either. They got worried later on. They didn't feel I was social enough. But early on, they thought that was, again, legitimate for me to spend all my weekends out by myself hunting pheasants or whatever it happened to be.
You're trying to raise money to put back this particular forest in Costa Rica.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of reception have you gotten for your money raising?
Okay, well, there's two things. There's the project itself, which is the actual act of doing it, putting the forest back, training Costa Ricans to be caretakers of that forest, and setting it up administratively so that basically it becomes part of the Costa Rican governmental structure and it's just there forever. I get an extremely favorable response to that, everywhere from audiences in the United States to the general lay public in Costa Rica to the farmers who are actually involved in actually doing it in Costa Rica. That part, no stumbling blocks, no
right.
problem. The financial response, which is the capital basically to get something like this started and going, is one that has been very puzzling to me, something I don't fully understand. Now, part of this, of course, is my own fault in the sense that as a field biologist all my life, I don't have the connections to the business community, to the corporation community, to the level of people who have the resources to be helpful in a project like this. So I'm sort of left screaming into the wind in a certain sense, saying, hey, we need help, but I don't have the directed focus with individuals that I can go after them.
Are you disheartened?
Not disheartened so much as becoming forced to the realization that unless there's some mechanism by which we can begin to reach out and directly contact individuals who have the resources to help, I don't see where the money's going to come from. And that's where I begin to feel a sense of extreme frustration because biologically, we know how to run this project. We have the Costa Ricans to do it. We have the Costa Ricans who want to do it. So I'm left only with a question of where do I find the actual capital to buy the actual dirt, which becomes Costa Rican National Park Service property, on which we actually do the reforestation. And the dirt is sitting there. The owners all want to sell it. And the question is, all right, the circumstances are perfect. Now, where do we find the actual cash to do it?
Do you see yourself as making a very significant contribution to the world of biology, to the understanding of biology, or do you think of yourself in those kinds of terms?
I don't normally think of myself in those kind of terms. If I stood outside of myself and looked at what I've done, honestly, I guess I would have to say, yes, I have made a major contribution. But you see, the problem is I don't do it in order to make a major contribution, all right? It's not like setting out to solve cancer or setting out to solve AIDS or something like that. I set out to understand how the world works, which is a less focused goal vis-a-vis the economic needs and the medical needs and all these things of humanity. Now, what I find out turns out to be useful to people. That's true. But I don't set out specifically to be explicitly useful to a person. The other half of that is the contribution to be made, I think, looking at what I'll spend the next 20 years doing, which is basically causing this rebuilding of a forest project to occur so that when I get hit by a car, it continues to run as though I'm not there. I feel that in a certain real sense, that will be a major contribution, even though, again, I'm not doing it for that purpose. I'm doing it because I'm driven to do it.
Well, I want to thank you really a lot for coming in and talking with us today.
Sure. You're very welcome.
Daniel Jansen has just returned to Costa Rica.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they've got for us. Hi, Renee.
Hi.
What do you have for us this afternoon?
Well, we have a business report. Automakers have begun to show big profits, it turns out, and that makes them happy and it's making their shareholders happy. But there's an argument that it's not such a good thing, that it would be better to sell more cars and make a less profit in order to get back a bigger share of the American market. Also, we have elephants on All Things Considered tonight, in a way. An interview with the author of a book, Elephant Memories, who lived for 13 years among the elephants of Africa. And a report on the ivory trade. And the ivory trade is responsible for the deaths of half of Africa's elephants over the last 10 years.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Critic Ken Tucker says if there are holes in your home video collection, there's a good reason for it.
Let me get this straight. The Manchurian Candidate isn't out on video cassette yet, but I can rent Shirley Temple in Curly Top? As the so-called video revolution proceeds apace, it's becoming an increasingly surreal enterprise. When VCRs first became common currency, there was much talk about how now even the most vulgar lout would build a collection of classic films. Great cinema would be screened at home, displacing Dynasty and The Cosby Show as primetime entertainment. It hasn't exactly turned out that way, has it? It seems as if most of what you can rent or purchase at your local video store is either the latest teen comedy or the same Katharine Hepburn movies that get played on late-night TV every other week anyway. The weirdest aspect of all this is that there is a collector's mentality at work among the video companies, but it's the most arbitrary sort of taste imaginable. For example, just over the past month, all or nearly all of the cinematic efforts of Shirley Temple, Abbott and Costello, and action film star Fred Williamson have become available on cassette. I mean, is there anyone out there who is looking to round out his collection of the classics with a fresh tape of Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm or Hell Up in Harlem? I'm willing to cut Abbott and Costello a little slack, mostly because their taste in lowbrow humor jibes with my own. While lots of people know that Bud and Lou were reasonably funny in familiar titles like Hit the Ice and Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, their best movie may have been In Society, in which the duo are a couple of plumbers. In this excerpt, the boys are being blackmailed by a tough guy who wants them to steal from one of their rich customers.
How's the plumbing business?
All right. We managed to keep our head above water.
Oh, that's fine. You know, I never told you fellas this, but I'm quite a fortune teller. I can see into the future. I see two plumbers. They're doing pretty good.
More competition.
But they're double-crossing a friend of theirs who gave them their start.
That's what I call being ungrateful. I have no use for those kind of people.
This friend of theirs is getting mad. Now he wants them to cooperate with him or to pay back the money he gave them. He's giving them till 6 o'clock tonight to get it.
But suppose they can't get it by 6 o'clock tonight?
Then I see two plumbers floating down the river. And one of them's a little fat guy.
What's the matter? The joke is on him.
Why?
I can't swim.
To be sure, all of the performers I mentioned earlier have their defenders and all made an interesting movie or two. Even Fred Williamson, the pro football star who became a fixture in black exploitation films in the early 70s, had his moments. These moments occurred whenever Williamson was directed by Larry Cohen. He's the cult favorite filmmaker best known for masterpieces of low-budget paranoia like The Private Files of J. Edgar Hoover and a horror movie called It's Alive. In Cohen-directed films like Black Caesar and Hell Up in Harlem, Fred Williamson's streetwise superhero has a bracing edge of parody. Shirley Temple, on the other hand, is a dicier proposition. The new raft of Temple on video includes The Littlest Colonel, The Littlest Rebel, Poor Little Rich Girl, and Little Miss Broadway, anything in short with little in the title. The Little Colonel, her most famous vehicle from 1935, is also her best film. If its sentimental plot seems tedious these days, it can now be viewed as a prime example of the way black actors like Bill Bojangles Robinson and Hattie McDaniel were at once showcased and exploited in the movies. As far as new films are concerned, I only have time to tell you that My Life as a Dog, a heartbreaking Swedish film nominated for the past year's Best Picture Oscar, is now available, but don't rent it. Why? Because Paramount Video has released an annoying dubbed version. Wait until May 18th when a print with subtitles becomes available.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a look at the next fresh air. On our next show, Terry Gross will speak with orchestrator and composer Jonathan Tunick. Though best known for his orchestrations of Stephen Sondheim musicals like Sweeney Todd and Into the Woods, he hopes to be recognized for his own compositions. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review a reissue of the post-war recordings of tenor saxophonist Don Byas. And television critic David Bianculli will preview The Trial of Bernard Goetz, this week's American Playhouse presentation on PBS. It's a dramatization of last year's subway vigilante trial in New York City. So hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landrell. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.